Warning, the following podcast may contain descriptions that some listeners may find distressing. Listener discretion is advised. Any views are all our own and do not in any way reflect the places where we work. Hello and welcome to Mini Mad or Bad. My name is Rachel.
And I'm Neil. Today, we will be discussing the phenomenon of false confessions in relation to true crime. Although over recent years this topic has been reoccurring in the news, it is not a new phenomenon. It was actually first mentioned in 1866 by Russian novelist Dostoevsky in his famous novel Crime and Punishment. Over the last 30 to 40 years worldwide, there have been hundreds of convictions that have subsequently been overturned by DNA or non-DNA evidence. Social psychologists Cassin and Reitzman suggested three distinct types of false confessions. The first is voluntary confessions. This can be when there is pressure on the confessor by others other than the police. So people more in their social circle, for instance. Someone may voluntarily confess for several reasons. This can be to protect the real criminal or criminals, or a desire for notoriety. A person may voluntarily confess due to an underlying psychological and or mental health issue.
So a compliant false confession is the second type of false confession that Cassin and Reitzman identify. This type of confession is in response to police coercion and the associated stress that that brings. It's often a type of confession that the confessor uses in order to bring around the end of an interrogation. And as such, this type of confession is often withdrawn once police interrogation ends. As well as the confessor believing it will end the interrogation, there is also a psychological inducement that explains its commonalities. The confessor will often believe that, as a suspect, they will be treated much more leniently if they confess at this stage, even though they themselves know that obviously they haven't committed a crime. Cassin and Reitzman believe that historically, particularly in the US, the fundamental coercing nature of the police interrogation procedure and the processes in itself is also a significant factor in this type of false confession.
I mean, it's a difficult thing, isn't it? Because, you know, what could be coercive to, say, me under these situations, you know, under a police interrogation?
Yeah.
Might not, if you were being interviewed for the same, you know, alleged crime. You might not feel that way. Might not feel that you'd be in particular, you know, on reflection that you were coerced into.
It's complicated, isn't
it? And the police, obviously, are under pressure.
The police,
it's a very difficult job, and they're always...
But there is good policing and there's bad
policing.
Absolutely, yeah. We've seen lots of examples of both. And if, you know, if you're into true crime, you have seen examples of both. You'd be aware of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's always very easy to criticise the police, of course, because they're in the front line of, you know...
And at the end of the day, they have pressures coming from above.
Yeah.
You know, they want to obviously close a case and get it done. Or I think sometimes it's a case of they truly do believe that person has done it. And I guess they probably maybe too early have kind of closed off other avenues and have really focused on this person.
Well, I mean, we've seen that quite often, haven't we? You know, in fact, I mean, we're talking about in England, aren't we, at the minute? There's a TV programme at the minute, isn't there, about the White House farm murders.
Yeah, and that's a prime example, isn't it?
And Stephen Graham, who's
of being very tunnel visioned.
Excellent actor, isn't he? Mm. And I think we're on about, is it episode 4 that we're going to watch tonight? Or some,
I've
six.
It's 5 tonight.
5 of 6, yeah. And he's really kind of a good example of that, isn't he?
Yeah.
So anyone, you know,
of
anyone
keeping an open mind and
of not keeping an open mind.
Sorry. The other fella is the guy.
Yeah, Mark Addy, I think, the actor, the other fella. Yeah, he's sort of open to, yeah.
Well, all the possibilities, really. Yeah. Whereas the other fella, it's just very much like, no, I believe this is what's happened.
Fits what we...
And completely tunnel-visioned. And I think as a result, that is bad policing, isn't it?
Well, I think you've always got to be open-minded, haven't you? You know.
Yeah, definitely. But as like going back to what you were saying about, you know, what I might feel is coercive might not necessarily put pressure on you or vice versa.
No, because personalities are different, aren't you, as well? I may be more of a, I don't know, nervous disposition, let's say.
And some people are more nervous around police, and people have different, levels of vulnerability and stress, and people react differently to that. So it's,
I think I would be very, very, I mean, hopefully I'll never get arrested, for murder that I've not done, because obviously I'm never going to do it.
I think if there's one thing
I'd never speak
to the police without...
Well, you don't, do you?
But I would have never have known that without, like, watching all the true crime stuff that we watch and stuff. Like, that's, like, if there was one message that I could take from, like, watching, do you know, all these Netflix documentaries all this stuff. It's you never speak to... You can be as innocent as anything.
Quite easily incriminate yourself.
You can incriminate yourself so easily.
Yeah.
And it's like, just never speak to the police without a solicitor.
Just solicitor first, and then, you know.
Yeah, so, yeah, definitely. So a persuaded false confession is when a confessor, due in part to police interrogation methods, comes to actually doubt their own memory of the alleged incident or crime that took place. So they're basically temporarily persuaded that it's more likely than not that they have committed the crime, which I think is kind of mad, actually.
I wonder when that could ever be... How could... You know, like, if you know that you've... I mean, I suppose...
There was an example that I came across. I think, I don't know, was it a Netflix documentary or was it something else? But it was a man. I have absolutely no idea where this has come from. But it was a man who, his daughters were saying that, I think two of his daughters were basically alleging that he had sexually abused them. And he, I don't know if this is the correct example, but he basically said, I don't remember it. But it must be true because they're saying it.
Why would they?
So that's kind of a little bit. And it's not that he has a false memory as such, but he's basically kind of doubting his own memory. He's saying he doesn't remember it, but he's saying it must be true because my daughters would never say.
And this is when the daughters were growing up, presumably, after
the...
So time as well.
Anyone knows what that is, please tweet us or something, because I don't know where I've gotten that from.
No.
But... somehow in my head, I know I've seen that somewhere, and it was very bizarre. But yeah, I can't imagine like being persuaded by police that I've done something that I haven't, though.
And,
like, are you sure that you didn't? Like, surely you'd know. Unless you were drunk or something, and you were kind of doubting your own memory.
Possibly. I mean, it's interesting that you said that, because that could well be...
Like, I mean, drunk at the time of the incident.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, we've all... Not that I've been drunk and murdered someone, but we've all been drunk and, you know, the feeling when you wake up the next morning.
Well, I've actually never had that.
Have you not?
Only maybe once.
Oh, good. Did I say that to... So, any bits come back to you, you know?
No, anyway. Bits have never come back, though. It's just been gaps.
Yeah, well, that's quite common, isn't it, if you go out and get pissed.
But then I guess you could be persuaded in a way.
I think you could then.
And then if you're persuaded, does it kind of almost implant itself in your memory as a real thing, even though...
I think if you were drunk, we'll
be covering false confessions in a later mini episode, so I'm going to be doing a lot of research on that. So I will let you know if I find out what the answer is.
This is false confessions.
Not false confessions.
I mean, hang on.
I mean, false memories.
False memories, yeah.
Yeah.
Just to clear it up, listeners, you are listening to false confessions.
Yeah, I'm confused. I'm very pregnant and very confused.
Cheers. I'm just confused. So
false memories is coming, but this is false confession.
Yeah, just to we will leave this bit in just so it's clear, you know.
For me.
For all of us, yeah. So a clear example of a persuaded false confession helps to account for the longest missed justice in terms of time served in the UK. So we go back to 1973 in Bakewell, Derbyshire, and the murder of 32-year-old Wendy Sewell. On Mad or Bad, the regular episodes, we've covered several local cases to where Rachel and I live. Similarly, this murder occurred, I think it's about 7-8 miles away, just up the A6 from where we live.
Hello, Mad or Bad listeners. We just wanted to take some time to say a massive thank you to Best Fiends for sponsoring this episode. Best Fiends is a really fun puzzle game that you can play on your phone, whether online or offline. Since being on maternity leave over the past few weeks, I've really needed to keep my brain active, as we all know there's only so much TV one can watch in a day. I'm enjoying Best Fiends as I can just pick it up at any time of the day and spend either a couple of minutes or even longer challenging my brain. I was stuck at a really long maternity appointment the other day, and honestly, I was so bored of waiting to see an array of professionals. Best Fiends happily kept me entertained and really made my 4-hour wait feel so much shorter. I love how you can also play either offline or online, so it doesn't really matter where you are. I also love how you can just pick it up and put it down whenever suits. It's such a cute, super casual game that anyone can really play. I'm really enjoying collecting all my cute little characters, and also I feel like I'm actually challenging my baby brain on a daily basis, which is keeping me ever so slightly sane on maternity leave before baby arrives. Best Fiends updates the game monthly, so there are always new levels, new characters to collect, and new challenges. The game has gotten so seriously popular. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is an absolute must play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play, and let us know on social media how much you are enjoying the game. That's Friends Without the Or, Best Fiends.
We just wanted to take some time to say a massive thank you to Podcorn, who is our sponsor for this episode. Podcorn is the easiest way for brands and podcasters to connect. It simplifies every aspect of podcast sponsorships. We have had such an easy and straightforward experience with them so far. You literally just simply sign up, view a dashboard of amazing advertising opportunities, and then you can write and submit a pitch and wait for the reply from a brand that you love. It's that easy to start monetizing your own podcast with sponsorships that work for your podcast. It's totally in your control and gives you full creative freedom and transparency. It's also suitable for podcasts of all shapes and sizes, which we think is amazing because obviously we're only starting off. So join Podcorn today. Just visit podcorn.com. That is Podcorn, P-O-D-C-O-R-N.
So watch your space. We may well cover this in a longer episode.
Bakewell is obviously home
Bakewell
to
pudding, if anyone's...
The Bakewell, well, tart, pudding. It should be a pudding, apparently.
Bakewell is Bakewell pudding, yeah.
The real thing is a pudding.
Yeah, yeah, and there's several shops there. They're very nice. Quite it is more of a dessert, though, than a little kind of cake. It is quite heavy. Quite heavy, do you know what
nice.
I mean?
It's nice.
Yeah, they are nice.
I like it.
Bakewell's a lovely place. Just recently, I think it was sort of back end of 2019. I think it was about a 6-part case, actually, if anyone's interested in listening to this. I think it's called Murder in the Graveyard. And a really interesting, like I say, 6-part podcast on the murder of Wendy Sewell. Well worth listening to, you know. Excellent, in my humble opinion.
We have like a running joke, though, don't we, that you've been working on this like dossier.
I'm working on... Neil's working on a dossier for this case. It's my lifetime's
Neil
work.
Neil, literally, like, sometimes we'd be driving, like, somewhere, and he's like, oh, can we just, like, go to Bakewell just to, like, see where it happened?
Like, well,
we've done that quite a few times.
Well, it's just up the road, you see. And this case received, obviously, you know, neither of us were around at the time, but lots of coverage at the time and at times since. It's a well-known case in Derbyshire and increasingly so across the UK. So, local Bakewell resident, Stephen Downing, so he was 17 years old in 1973. At that time, he apparently had some learning difficulties with a reading age of 11, although some sources suggest or state that it was 8 or 9. Defining somebody's reading age, you know, inherently it's filled with lots of potential inaccuracies regarding the actual capabilities of a person.
Well,
you know,
all you can say is factually he was reading at the age of whatever, 11 or 8-year-old.
Yeah,
doesn't necessarily mean that other forms of intellect
were
that were that age, I guess.
Yeah.
We don't know.
We don't know for certain. I do think there was some, when Stephen was at school, there was some kind of, he had some difficulties there as regarding his learning. But at the time, 1973, Stephen was working full-time for Bakewell Town Council as a gardener. He lived with his mum, who was a housewife, and dad, who at the time was a bus driver, and younger sister. On the 12th of September 1973, whilst working as a gardener in Bakewell Cemetery, he came across 32-year-old Wendy. She'd been attacked and was lying on a footpath. Wendy subsequently died at the Royal Chesterfield Hospital 2 days later, having never regained consciousness. Wendy lived not in Bakewell, but kind of a bus ride out, I think probably 4 or 5 miles from Bakewell. She worked in Bakewell.
Oh yeah, I was just going to ask, what was she worked in Bakewell?
She was a kind of an admin worker. There's probably more to it than that. I'm just an admin worker, just kind of generally.
Yeah.
For the Forestry Commission, actually in Bakewell. She knew Bakewell well, and apparently was known in, you know, she was quite sort of.
Why was she in the cemetery, do we know?
It was on a lunch break, and she, I believe her father, Wendy's father, had quite recently passed away, and Wendy was close to her dad, and she was, I think, looking in there for sort of looking at different gravestones. She was thinking what to sort of,
yeah, fair enough,
what type to get. I mean, if you listen to the Murder in the Graveyard podcast, and if we cover this as well, obviously we'll cover it in more detail. There's some suggestion that Wendy was there meeting another man. Wendy was married.
I mean, it doesn't really matter why she was there, to be fair.
Absolutely,
No,
but just to answer it, yeah. Wendy was very cruelly, the papers at the time and subsequently dubbed the Bakewell Tart.
That's,
which is absolutely
disgusting.
Horrendous. This is somebody that lost the life and viciously attacked and lost the life. And that's the newspapers for in England. I'm sure it's the same anywhere, but flipping horrible though, isn't it?
Yeah, that's disgusting.
Anyway, so shortly after the attack itself, Stephen was arrested and taken into custody. Shortly after the attack itself, Stephen was arrested and questioned for, some sources say, up to 11 or 12 hours at Bakewell Police Station. During the entirety of the questioning, he had no solicitor present, nor any responsible adult with him.
Bearing in mind, he was 17 years old.
He was 17 years old, yeah.
This child.
Yeah. This was despite, obviously, 17-year-olds don't think they're children, but, you know.
But they are.
So, and by law, they are, aren't they?
Yes.
So, which is, you know. So this is despite his father asking on several occasions throughout Stephen's questioning to speak with his son. As Stephen's interrogation went on, Stephen complained increasingly of, you know, severe back pain. He was sat on a kind of wooden chair and obviously he was in pain, you know, for that many hours.
I wondered, like, did he get any breaks or anything?
Well,
do you know what I mean?
He might have been allowed to go to the toilet, but I think it was...
But it all contributes to, like, the stress of that situation.
Of course,
isn't it?
If you're getting bad back pain,
you're going to end up just being like, "Yeah, I fucking did it," because actually, I just can't fucking sit here any longer.
Yeah, I mean, I remember at university, you know, like if you sat, I mean, this might have only been flipping 3 hours with a little break in the middle. You know,
yeah,
sat down on uncomfortable chairs,
you
flipping feel it.
Yeah,
you know,
and you're exhausted, like mentally, emotionally.
University or police?
No,
or
the police station.
At times, yeah.
Well, you know, you're having to concentrate and answer these questions.
Yeah.
Jesus,
yeah,
it's
absolutely.
It's a lot to put up with, isn't
absolutely.
It?
So, in addition, many sources suggested at the time, Bakewell had a very kind of, like a lot of places, small-town mentality. And there was a particular police sergeant who was kind of seemingly determined to get Stephen to confess.
Did he just have a thing against our family?
I think he was seen as the big, you know, like the big chief kind of thing in town. And and I think a couple of years before, I mean, we'll discuss this if we cover this. We'll go into much more detail.
Just not a six-parter.
No. It might be a two-parter. So
that would be cool.
I know we're not kind of going into the ins and outs of it, but it's just an example of a type of confession. So
yeah.
Please, you know, I kind of apologise that. To some extent, but we will cover it. It's also worthy of note that during the interrogation, Stephen was not privy as to any updates regarding Wendy's condition. As far as Stephen knew at that time, he wasn't being questioned for murder.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah, because she was still alive. Well, to his knowledge, she was still alive at this time.
Yeah, Stephen did not foresee that Wendy would die as a result of the assault. Wendy was briefly conscious at the scene of the attack, which would have further added to Stephen's belief that the incident was, you know, far less serious than it actually ended up being. I mean, obviously, you find somebody that's been beaten with a... It was like a pickaxe handle, actually, around her head. Yeah, that's bad, but it's a whole new thing, isn't it?
Yeah, well, she was still alive.
If we're talking
it
murder.
Wasn't murder.
Yeah,
such.
I mean, I don't think she was in a great condition, but there's a big...
big difference.
Big difference, yeah. So although we've said... We touched on that Stephen had a reading age of, well, 8 to 11. It's hard to actually gauge his ability to grasp the reality of the situation. I mean, let's face it, it'd be hard for blooming anyone, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So the reading age in itself is not necessarily indicative of his ability or inability to understand the gravity of the situation. The reality is we just don't have that information as to...
I mean, and if when we cover this...
We need to look into
we'll,
that.
We'll go into this.
Yeah. So Stephen subsequently said that he was asked to sign a prepared written statement, and then he just wanted to end the interrogation and see his parents as soon as possible, which is, you know, completely understandable.
Absolutely. You
really.
Just want to get the hell out of there, won't you?
Absolutely. A short while after the interrogation ended, Stephen retracted his confession, maintaining his absolute innocence. He continued to maintain his innocence at trial and throughout his 27 years in prison. So he was imprisoned for the murder of Wendy.
I think the year after the trial was, and
As a prisoner in denial of murder, he knew there would be limited chance of parole and was detained at Her Majesty's pleasure with no release date.
No, that's it, isn't it? Because he as far as they were concerned...
He's like, oh...
I didn't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. A local editor, though, Don Hale, he worked at the Matlock Mercury, he actually ended up picking up the case and spent about 6 years helping to prove Stephen's innocence. And eventually he was released in 2001.
And I remember in 2001, actually, just before we move on to the next example, that, yeah, I remember it was all over the, you know, it was all over the papers. And I think Stephen still lives in, and his sister still live in Bakewell today. And absolutely so they bloody should be, shouldn't they? But I know Don Hale as well. He was editor of Matlock Mercury for, I think, for a good... I might be wrong here, but I'm going to say 15 years. Mm. And he's on that podcast that I've mentioned. And he's also... He did a book when Stephen was released.
Yeah.
And
Have you read that book?
Yeah, but he also... It was re-released with additional... sort of, you know, bits in, I think, last 2019, 2018. And that's called In Denial of Murder. Well worth a read. So a good example of a compliant confession is the case of Sean Hodgson. So 30-year-old Sean, he was a convicted car thief, told a prison chaplain in 1980 that he had murdered a 22-year-old woman. He has said that he killed 22-year-old Teresa DeSimone, who he said he had found sleeping in his car. As well as telling the chaplain in his London prison, he was in prison at that time for car theft, he repeated his confession both verbally and in written form up until the time of his trial.
Really wanted to get it across, didn't he?
He did, didn't he? Which was like the year after.
Yeah.
He also made mention, although we couldn't find anything kind of specific as to the detail of this, not only that he had murdered Teresa, but he was also responsible for two other murders. So the following year at his trial, he withdrew the confession. He denied that he had ever murdered anyone. He himself said he was a, quote, pathological liar. He said that himself.
So bizarre.
Although withdrawing his confession, he was convicted of Teresa's murder. Sean's blood type was the same that was found on Teresa's body. This, together with largely circumstantial evidence, led Sean to spend 27 years in prison. He was only eventually released after DNA results conclusively cleared him of any wrongdoing. As to why Sean falsely confessed to the murder, it is not conclusively understood, perhaps even by Sean himself. Dr. Ian Anderson, a chartered psychologist, believes that Sean suffered from a type of personality disorder and had a craving for fame and notoriety. Although, interestingly, he only had that for a year, though, didn't he? Perhaps at that time when he went to trial, you know, he'd had enough notoriety.
Yeah, I've had enough now.
I've had enough now. I bloody didn't do it.
Yeah, it's really, really bizarre.
But he didn't do it, you know. That's the...
Well, it serves him right, messing around, getting 27 years.
Well, Yes and no. If he had some kind, you know, personality disorder, that's not his fault.
It's not his fault that he's a personality disorder, but that doesn't make you say something.
No, but he, I mean, to be fair to Sean, we don't know all the details here. And I think it would take another two-parter on Sean, wouldn't it, to understand it all. And this is just a little example. So, you know, if we were covering this in full, we would go into this.
Interesting, though. Yeah. So you may remember another example of this type of false confession in an earlier episode. So episode number 11, Linda Mann and Don Ashworth.
Well worth a listen, if I say so myself.
In which a 17-year-old youth initially confessed to murdering Dawn in the 1980s. If you want to hear more about this case, obviously go back and listen to it. It's episode number 11. So, historically, police coercion was a large factor in obtaining false confessions. However, with DNA technology and improved police training into areas such as mental health, as well as the PACE procedures, have led to a reduction in false confessions and generally protecting more vulnerable suspects.
Absolutely, as it should be.
Yeah, definitely. Nowadays, it is more common for people to falsify confessions, whether they mistakenly but genuinely believe that they have committed a particular crime.
I wonder if, you know, that could well be people with mental health problems.
Vulnerable
people, isn't it?
But I am quite interested in PACE procedures and stuff. You can just Google it and look it up, and there's like, I think...
Do you remember the TV series last year with
A Confession.
Martin Freeman? Yeah.
That was brilliant.
Yeah, where he didn't follow PACE.
Yes.
And you can see why, obviously, PACE is in place, but you can also... It's very good, isn't it? I'm sure a lot of people have seen this.
I get a confession.
And anyone not listening in the UK, was that on the BBC or the ITV?
I think.
ITV.
Google it.
I mean, it may be very
Martin long. Freeman, a confession.
Yeah.
Didn't follow PACE procedures, and then it kind of follows on from that, really, about how he lost his job and stuff.
Mm. But he has no regrets.
No, and when you watch it, like, yeah, I get it.
Yeah, because he found that, yeah.
But I also get why PACE procedures are there.
Yeah,
so it's just difficult, but really interesting, though.
But anyway, hope you've liked this mini Mad or Bad episode.
Yes, kind of a pit stop run through of false confessions, really.
Yeah, yeah.
We will see you back next week for a full episode. Yeah, so thanks for listening.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Bye.
As always, catch us on facebook.com/madorbad. You can catch us on Twitter. Our handle is @madorbadthepod. And also, we now have a Patreon account. So please go look us up. It is patreon.com/madorbad. You can access exclusive content. We have exclusive episodes only available to Patreon supporters. So, go find us.